Good morning. I'm delighted to welcome you to the Supreme Court hearing room for three arguments today. And we are especially delighted to welcome students from Port Washington High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a cleverly entitled program called Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to come to the courtroom, listen to an oral argument, and meet with a justice assigned for the day. The meeting with these students is after the second oral argument, which is roughly 12:15. And the discussion involves the procedure of the court in taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case we are about to hear. We have a summary of the case, and if anyone would like to see it, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. In light of no hands, I'll just proceed and introduce the court to you all since we have met you. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To Justice Crooks's left is Justice Patience Robensack, and to her left is Justice Michael Gableman. With these introductions made, we will turn to our first case for this morning, 11AP2188, State of Wisconsin ex rel. Greer versus Wiedenhoff. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Greer is Jennifer M. Severino. Counsel, you may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Severino, here representing the petitioner, Ardonis Greer. Your Honors, this is a pretty basic, straightforward case in terms of the facts. There's no disagreement regarding what occurred here. The Department of Corrections failed to enter Mr. Greer's three-year consecutive probation period into their computer system. And due to that mistake, Mr. Greer was issued a discharge certificate at the end of his first sentence instead of following through and doing three more years of probation. This case asked the court several basic questions. They include what fundamental fairness demands, what the powers of a court sitting in certiorari have, and what the remedy available is to Mr. Greer. This court should reverse the holding of the Court of Appeals for three reasons. First, because the issuance of the discharge certificate vacated the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. Second, because even if the DOC did retain jurisdiction in this matter, it should be equitably stopped from proceeding with revocation. And third, because the process that was lacking in this case resulted in a substantive due process violation on behalf of Mr. Greer. Moving to my first point, the issue of jurisdiction in this case. Both sides have essentially relied on the same case law in making the argument on jurisdiction. There isn't a lot of case law in this state on the issue of a discharge certificate and jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. Essentially, the cases that we're relying upon are State ex rel. Rodriguez versus the Department of Health and Social Services and State versus Stefanovic. Both of these cases have language that emphasizes the legal significance of these discharge certificates. And that is the language that Greer asked this court to pay special attention to. Mr. Greer received a discharge certificate telling him that he was absolutely discharged and that his civil rights were reinstated, including the right to vote and the duty for jury service. And he relied upon this and acted in voting in the presidential election in 2008. That was prior to what would have been the end of the three-year time period had the Department of Corrections continued to monitor him. There's no dispute about that by the parties.
But a circuit court have just issued paperwork and changed its sentence?
You mean the sentence modification, Your Honor?
I mean, if the circuit court signed this piece of paper, would that have been valid?
Your Honor, the circuit court does not have the ability to modify a sentence without some sort of reason, as is outlined in the statutes.
And so my question is, why should the department be able to undermine a sentence that was given by the circuit court,
Your Honor,
when the court itself couldn't do it?
Sure. Your Honor, in this case, the reason that Petitioner Greer is asking for the court to rule on the jurisdiction issue, number one, is to clarify it for the courts. But number two, it's because Greer believes that once the Department of Corrections issues these absolute discharge certificates, the one that specifically reinstate the civil rights, that is directly linked to jurisdiction. Because once your civil rights have been reinstated and you're free from the intrusion of the Department of Corrections, they should not be able to come back 2 or 3 years later and say it was a mistake.
Was he present at sentencing?
Your Honor, Mr. Greer was physically present at his sentencing.
Was it somehow unclear that it was a consecutive sentence?
Your Honor, the transcript of the sentencing hearing was never provided by the state as evidence to support their contention regarding what was said at the hearing. The Court of Appeals and the Department of Corrections assume that because a judge has to explain a sentence, that it was properly explained to Mr. Greer, but we don't have that transcript.
Is your client disputing that it was properly explained to him?
He does, Your Honor. In fact, in the only evidence that's in the record is the information from my client in which he says, I was present at sentencing, and I heard that I had a three-year sentence, and I served a three-year sentence. I served 14 months of initial confinement and 22 months of extended supervision. He said the on page 184 of my appendix is his statement that he made at the revocation hearing. He said, I was in court, but I don't have any acknowledgement of consecutive concurrent. Those things are not definite to me. I don't know the difference between those two. All I knew was that I had a three-year sentence and I served one. There's the department conceded at the revocation hearing that Mr. Greer never had a copy of his judgment of conviction and that he was never told during that three-year time period that he was either in prison or being supervised about the consecutive probation. So even if it had been mentioned to him at the sentencing hearing, we don't have a transcript to describe how detailed that explanation was. It could have just been...
Are you seeking to withdraw his plea to that count?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
Resentenced on that count if he didn't understand what his sentence was on the second count?
No, we're not, Your Honor. At this point, the only issue is whether his reliance upon the certificate was reasonable or not. And that's what his testimony at the revocation hearing specifically goes to. He indicated that had he known about the consecutive probation, he would have continued to report and comply with the terms as he had been when he was on extended supervision. The petitioner understands that asking the court to apply a bright-line rule based on jurisdiction is a test that could result in some results that might not be considered popular by the court. And understands, though, that this court will rule on the narrowest grounds possible and that that's how appellate courts generally review these cases. And that is why the issues of the application of equitable estoppel and the substantive due process violations are important to address in this case. The circuit court in this case applied equitable estoppel in the writ of certiorari action because he was concerned with the question of whether the Department of Corrections acted according to law or not. And what he indicated is that the question of fundamental fairness and due process, which are part of the question of whether the Department of Corrections acted according to law or not, in this case, it would not be fundamentally fair, and it would be a violation of Mr. Greer's rights to revoke him under these circumstances. The state or the Department of Corrections has argued in their brief that the equitable estoppel is not applicable in writ of certiorari cases. And while it's true that historically writ of certiorari courts do not apply equitable principles, it does not mean that they're not, it does not mean that they're limited in applying them in a defensive way as a defensive doctrine against government action. And that's precisely what the court did in this case. He applied the analysis that's already been established by this court in other cases to weigh the pros and cons of applying this and keeping in consideration the concerns for the public safety.
Counselor, Mr. Greer was revoked because he committed a crime, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And one of the elements of equitable estoppel is that you have to reasonably rely on an action, and are you trying to tell us that he reasonably relied on the discharge summary to be able to commit a crime?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing.
Then I don't understand how you get around the fact he got revoked for committing a crime.
Your Honor, Mr. Greer does not contest that him committing a crime was a criminal violation and he should be punished for that. And he pled guilty, or he entered a plea, and he was sentenced in separately for that action. What the problem is in this case is that he was unaware that his actions would also have other ramifications, meaning the six-year imposed and stayed sentence that was connected to this probation.
He was unaware that if he committed a crime, he could be subject to something in the criminal justice system? You're kind of losing me on your argument.
Well, Your Honor, he was certainly aware that he could be prosecuted, but a prosecution, you know, there's a huge difference for an individual in the community understanding that if they are on probation or extended supervision and they get revoked, that there's this sentence hanging over their head and that they know that they may have to go immediately serve a sentence.
Okay.
Then knowing that there's a potential new criminal prosecution. You know, we don't know what would have happened if Mr. Greer had continued to have been supervised on probation. Probation's a process, and, you know, with the help of his agent, any issues that may have arisen during that supervision may have been addressed, and this situation may have never even come up. We can't know that because he was never given the opportunity to comply with the terms of probation. He was never told he needed to comply with the terms of probation.
Well, he's always on notice. You can't break the law. I'm on notice. You're on notice. He's on notice, too, right?
Correct. But being on notice that you can't break the law is different than having knowledge of what ramifications for your actions might be. Mr. Greer went through 22 months of extended supervision without a single violation. He clearly was capable of complying with the rules of probation, complying with the law, and doing what was asked of him by the Department of Corrections. They told him, stop reporting, you're done. We're converting, you know, your unpaid fees to a civil judgment, which was then signed off on in this case by the circuit court. And they told him to go on his way and live his life. Now, committing a new crime certainly is the problem in this case. And Mr. Greer is not contesting that fact. And he's accepted responsibility for that, and he's accepting whatever punishment the court gives him on the new case. But what he's not accepting is the fact that he is looking at a six-year imposed and stayed sentence for behavior that occurred during a time period when he had no contact whatsoever with the Department of Corrections. He had no knowledge that his behavior could result in a revocation. And he was essentially blindsided, ripped away from his job, school, his family, and placed into custody when the mistake was discovered without any sort of notice that this was going to be occurring.
Counsel, I wonder, did I understand you correctly to say in response to Justice Rogensack's first question that your client or you acknowledge that Mr. Greer did in fact receive a copy of the judgment of conviction?
No, quite the opposite. The Department of Corrections testified at the revocation hearing that Mr. Greer was never provided a copy of his judgment of conviction.
Never provided it. His defense counsel was?
His defense counsel, as was explained, the way that the Racine County does judgment of convictions, they send a copy to defense counsel, but it's up to defense counsel to personally pass it on to the client. Mr. Greer testified that he never received a copy of it, and his agent testified that the Department of Corrections never provided him a copy of it. So
is it your position that once this discharge certificate was issued, that's it? Nothing can be done to have the sentence that was imposed given full effect?
That's our argument on jurisdiction, correct, Your Honor.
What if the opposite would have happened? What if they would have, what if he should have been discharged, or what if he somehow fulfilled the requirement and instead of issuing a discharge certificate, they did the opposite and wanted to hold them? Would there be any recourse for him under that group of facts? Or is the department just the, once the judge sentenced, the department can do whatever it wants and, you know, the judge's sentence is sort of irrelevant?
Well, Your Honor, the defendants certainly would have recourse if they're being held longer than what is legally possible under a sentence, but that's exactly Greer's position on this case, is that we need to determine what the remedy is when individuals in Greer's position find themselves, you know, without knowledge or without being supervised, and what the remedy would be. You know, obviously the jurisdiction and arguing straight jurisdiction would be a bright line rule. However, this court does not need to rule explicitly on that, and could also determine that under either equitable estoppel or the due process analysis that there was a violation, and that under either of those grounds, Mr. Greer revocation should be overturned.
So you said he thought he served 3 years, that's it, 3 years, done. And you're telling me the sentence that was imposed and stayed was 6 years?
You never heard that? He was given, the imposed and stayed sentence was 3 years of initial confinement, 3 years of extended supervision, and then he was placed on 3 years of probation. So his...
There was no imposed and stayed sentence?
There was a 6-year imposed and stayed, 3 years in and 3 years of extended supervision, and then that was stayed for the 3 years of probation. So the number 3 is essentially what Mr. Greer heard at the sentencing when the sentence was described to him. Mr. Greer is a layperson who doesn't understand the distinction between consecutive and concurrent, and certainly doesn't have the legal chops to understand that, you know, a probation sentence can't be run concurrent to a prison sentence. And that might have been what his impression was based upon the fact that during that 14 months he was in prison and the 22 months he was on extended supervision, no one ever mentioned this to him. The Department of Corrections didn't know about it. So when he was getting all of his paperwork with his discharge dates from the day he initially went up to Dodge for intake, those dates always had the 3 years being the end of the time period. And so he had this in his head for the entire 3-year time period that was what the sentence was. And he believed when he received the discharge certificate that it was a valid certificate and that he had successfully completed all of the requirements of his sentence. He was told not to report. The administrative law judge even found in his decision that Mr. Greer was not under any rules at the time that he was not supervised because of the fact that they had told him not to report and they had never told him that he was on probation. The only violation that essentially resulted in the revocation was this commission of this new crime. And again, Mr. Greer is not contesting the state's ability to prosecute him for the new crime, but it is contesting their ability to use the new crime as a basis for the revocation when he was unaware that this revocation was a possibility when he committed the act.
Counsel, you've discussed in response to Justice Ziegler's question your first argument, that is your argument on jurisdiction. And your argument in part is that the certificate of discharge is the be-all and end-all, so to speak. But you have two other arguments. One is cert and the third is due process. And can you tell me why you think that he should prevail on the due process argument?
The Court of Appeals essentially, because they didn't address the estoppel argument, they addressed the concerns about fundamental fairness through due process argument. And certainly the substantive due process question and even the procedural due process question arise in a case like this where notice is kind of an issue. As I've indicated, the courts have recognized that the phrase acted according to law, which is one of the things that are analyzed when you're looking at a revocation decision, includes the common law concepts of due process and fair play. In this case, Mr. Greer was not provided with notice that his actions could result in a revocation or could result in him having to serve a prison sentence, aside from any new charges. And without that sort of forewarning or knowledge of what was going to be happening to him. He did not have the ability to conform his actions in a way to prevent some sort of negative result. As I've indicated, he told the administrative law judge at the revocation hearing that he believed that he had successfully completed his sentence. And when looking at the substantive due process analysis, the question is, even if the process is fair, is there still a violation where the individual's rights become interfered with? The Department of Corrections here had an obligation to accurately maintain their records and to accurately fulfill the obligation to Mr. Greer and to the court system to monitor the sentence.
I have a question for you. I'm sorry to interrupt. But you started this argument on substantive due process. In your response to Justice Bradley, you added procedural due process. So let me put this case to you in this way. The Department of Corrections has to follow the sentence that the judge imposed, right? You agree with that?
Correct.
They can't change that without coming back or fulfilling various requirements, right?
Correct, unless they file under the statute that permits early termination.
Right. And they didn't. So the Department of Corrections is bound by the judge's sentence, which that's the Department of Corrections. And, of course, you know, courts are very zealous, as they should be, of their jurisdiction and their powers. And if the judge sentences, we all expect that to be followed, right?
Correct.
That doesn't bode well for your client.
Well, Your Honor, the problem...
Let me just finish. For your client, that's why the case is here, because there's another side to the story, right? Well, your client, he appears at sentence. You can read a lot of stuff about a defendant at sentencing doesn't absorb very much in light of the crises involved in sentencing. That's why he's given a copy of the conviction and the sentence so he can read it at his leisure, which will be a lot of leisure in prison. And so that's his side. And he says, I didn't get that. And he says, you know, it's 3 years later or whatever the amount is, and like memories fade, and I can't remember if it was consecutive or concurrent, and I did the best I can. I asked the department, not once, not twice, but a couple of times, right? That's in favor of your client. And he was told, you're a free guy, right? Now the department wants to increase, put not precisely under the law, but in effect, the department wants to increase the penalty for the crime that he commits, the second crime, increase the penalty by revoking the probation and adding to it, right? That's not technically correct under the law, but that's the effect of this, right?
Correct.
And you say, how fair can that be? I don't have notice that the penalty is going to be increased. You had an obligation to help me for 3 years. You didn't help me. That's not fair. Okay, that's the procedure. So why is this not procedural due process on notice? And then I have to ask, you want the revocation to be struck down, right?
That's correct.
Why shouldn't the court say that the probation should be reinstated now and that he has to complete his term that he had that was mistakenly dropped, and that if he violates probation, he has a revocation? So isn't that a fairer thing for both the department and for your client?
To address your first question regarding the procedural due process, Your Honor, Mr. Greer has asserted that both procedural and substantive due process violations occurred here.
I know you did that in your brief. Okay.
I did, Your Honor. And Mr. Greer believes that, the alternative, obviously, if the court finds that the notice issue, meaning he was physically present at court for his sentencing, therefore he should have known, which was the Court of Appeals decision on this case, that there was no procedural due process, then the substantive due process analysis would step up. In terms of what the remedy is for Mr. Greer, should the revocation be overturned, there are a couple of different options. One is the one that Your Honor suggested, which would be he simply restart the 3 years of probation, and Mr. Greer would be amenable to that. The other option, which was originally discussed with him and originally offered when they discovered this mistake, was that they would tell him what the total fees would have been for the 3 year time period, permit him to pay what the supervision fees would have been, and then wait these 27 days that were remaining on the 3 year time period, let him serve those on probation, and then just let him discharge at the end of the 3 year time period. That was originally discussed with him when this was originally discovered, and that is what the Department of Corrections initially discussed with him as being the resolution they were leaning towards. As is indicated during the testimony of the revocation hearing, the Department of Corrections received a phone call from the district attorney's office basically saying, we want you to pursue revocation because of this new charge. And the Department of Corrections acted on that and pursued revocation. And then at that point, it was kind of off the table. Resolving it any other way was no longer in their game plan. These other options were discussed with them multiple times prior to going to hearing, and they were rejected by the Department of Corrections. Once they made that decision, it left Mr. Greer in the position he's in now, where all he could do was make the arguments that he's been making since day one, the jurisdiction argument, the due process argument, and the question of what is the remedy here. The circuit court in this case went out of their way to look at the facts and try to determine a fair way of resolving the case given the failures of the Department of Corrections, and assuring that the Department of Corrections understands they need to carefully monitor and keep track of their paperwork. And applying something like equitable estoppel, like the circuit court did, is something that is easy to apply because it's a form that they use all the time and it's a standard that they use all the time. And it takes into account all of the concerns of releasing somebody who should have been on supervision, essentially. Those concerns for rehabilitation are already taken care of in terms of his new charge and the sentence that he received there. The protection of the public has been addressed with his new sentence and the sentence that he received there. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors.
Okay, counsel, I just you might consider equitable estoppel against the government under the best of circumstances is a very difficult burden of proof and not favored in the law. You can probably find very few cases where the government is estopped. And and you've got the double burden here of certiorari and whether or not that can be done. So you should consider that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey J. Castle, Assistant Attorney General, representing Wayne Wiedenfeld.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle. I think, Justice Ziegler, in your first question to Mr. Greer's counsel, you put your finger on the nub of what's at stake here. The petitioner is asking this court to hold that an administrative error by the Department of Corrections nullified a circuit court order placing him on probation. As counsel stated, there's no dispute that this was simply an administrative error, and as a result, at the end of the first of the two consecutive sentences, a discharge certificate was issued.
What does administrative error mean?
In this case, the error was the failure to enter into the Department of Corrections record-keeping system the second sentence.
Oh, that was a a first error that was technical on a piece of paper. But it was followed by a review of his file by the DOC and repeating that error. And then the other error, as I see it, and I don't know how you can label it administrative, was the department disobeyed the court rule by not supervising him. Right? I don't call that administrative. Well, and what's the remedy against the Department of Corrections for violating the court order?
I think the second and third errors you identify all flowed as a matter of course. It was not as though the second error, the issuance of the discharge or the failure to supervise, were some kind of were an intentional.
No, but they were continuing, and I don't know whether they were intentional or not. They certainly were careless. Didn't the department have the sentencing transcript?
I assume so.
Didn't the department have the judgment of conviction?
I would assume so.
Right, and didn't they show that there was probation consecutive?
Yes.
This is hardly administrative.
Well, we don't have anything in the record that shows anything about how the discharge certificate comes to be about. I think it's reasonable to assume that it all flows from the initial failure to enter that second sentence.
The probation. The loss of a nail, right?
Excuse me?
For the loss of a nail.
Yes. Now, Mr. Greer argues that there are three theories that caused the department to lose its ability to enforce the probationary term and his violation of that probation by committing a new crime. The first is loss of jurisdiction, second is equitable estoppel, and the third is due process. Counsel emphasized substantive due process during her argument. Returned somewhat to procedural due process. Let me first address the jurisdictional issue. The contention that even an erroneously issued discharge certificate causes the Department of Corrections to lose jurisdiction over a supervisee, that contention is unsupported by any statutory citation, any statutory authority, or any authority in the case law. Mr. Greer has identified a couple of Court of Appeals decisions that he says supports the view that the department loses jurisdiction when a discharge certificate is issued, but neither of those cases involve an invalid discharge certificate. There's no question here this discharge certificate was not valid. A discharge certificate, unless some other statutory provision allows it, a discharge certificate may only be issued at the end of the court order term. It was ordered instead about 3 days into the court order term.
Indeed, it is that first issue, the jurisdiction issue, that focuses on what a department can do to a circuit court's decision. And I find not overwhelmingly persuasive the idea that a error can vitiate a court sentence and order, an error by the department. So that's the focus of the first issue. But it seems to me the remaining two issues don't deal with that focus, but rather deal with whether or not the department can revoke under these circumstances. So we're not dealing with the department vitiating the decision of the judge, but whether the department's decision to revoke can be sustained.
And so that's I guess, for me, the focus.
Well, I mean, I agree that the jurisdictional issue, if you're suggesting the jurisdictional issue is an easy one, I would agree.
I said not overwhelmingly persuasive.
If you want to translate this, you can.
I will accept.
You agree with that too, right?
I agree with that as well. I mean, it could hardly be otherwise, because if they're, you know, if two inmates had the same name, one is serving a lifetime supervision or 20 or 30 years and gets a certificate of discharge because the department confused the names, you could hardly argue that someone is freed from lifetime supervision because of that mistake. So let me turn then to equitable estoppel. And here I think the determinative issue is, can a court sitting in certiorari apply equitable estoppel or other equitable remedies? I argued in my brief that the court's decision in Town of Delafield versus Winkleman establishes that equitable relief is not available in a certiorari proceeding. I also cited a fairly recent Court of Appeals decision for that point. And in my letter responding to Mr. Greer's letter of supplemental authority, I pointed out that this proposition that Winkleman states, that equitable relief is not available in certiorari, actually has a venerable history in the court. It goes back to the 1920s.
Why doesn't it fall under its action was arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable? That's the one of the four cert standards of review, right?
Yes.
So if the court should say that it's not fair and it's unreasonable to apply this rule, why doesn't that fall under the certiorari review? It's that the DOC's action was arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable. Sounds to me, if it's equitable to go one way, that means it's unreasonable and oppressive and arbitrary to go the other.
Well, because I think that term, arbitrary, unreasonable, within certiorari review, has a very narrow meaning. In fact, all of certiorari review is. We heard counsel for Mr. Greer say, well, the certiorari court was weighing the harm to the public versus fairness and all these circumstances. That's exactly what the agency is doing. In a certiorari review, that kind of weighing is not for the certiorari court. Notion that we apply equitable principles in a certiorari review, it would have very far-reaching ramifications. Certiorari review is, after all, the basis for reviewing many state agency decisions, municipal decisions as varied as liquor license, tavern license, land use, zoning, public assistance. If we say a certiorari court has free range to consider fairness, to weigh the evidence about whether Mr. Greer's danger to the public is not as great as the unfairness to him, then we're substituting the court's view for that of the agency. And I would say goes well beyond scope of certiorari review.
That's not the only review that it does under arbitrary, oppressive, or unreasonable. It reviews whether or not when the department has erred several times, when the department has released somebody from probation, whether it's arbitrary then to impose probation again retroactively and punish retroactively for something that the department said he didn't have to do. And isn't that arbitrary? So we're not balancing his punishment or his public safety against him. We're balancing the activity, the conduct of the Department of Corrections when there's a no notice and the department has in effect overruled the court sentence improperly.
Well, improperly, and I think that's certainly an important factor in...
That's right. So now aren't they oppressive and arbitrary and unreasonable doubling back on him?
Is
that the way we want the system to run?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
And is that the way this system should run?
No, we would like a system that is 100% error-free.
But we're not going to get that.
We're not going
to
get that.
To that question, right.
No, but let's try for 98%.
Even 98 would be that would be a lot of mistakes, given the unfortunate number of people under supervision. In my brief, I cited a Seventh Circuit case that had pretty strikingly similar facts. It wasn't a certiorari proceeding. It was rather a federal habeas proceeding. But in fact, involved someone who was in a Wisconsin prison, but he was serving that sentence after completing prison on a federal sentence. And it's, I believe the case is the Matamoros case I cited. And the facts are very similar. In Matamoros, because of the offense, the defendant not only was required to serve a regular probation term, but what was under federal law called a special parole term. When he finished his regular parole term, his agent told him, "You're done." He was provided a certificate of discharge, very much like what's here. He should not have been provided a certificate of discharge. He was not done. He then went out and committed a new crime. The federal government lodged a detainer against him. He was in a Wisconsin state prison, and he filed a habeas corpus saying, "I'm unlawfully being held in custody as a result of this detainer." And the Seventh Circuit considered whether the federal government, Federal Bureau of Prisons, was stopped from lodging a detainer. And it said, it's an open debate whether estoppel could even be applied against the government. But we'll assume that it can be. But if it can be, it can only apply in situations where it would work an injustice, where it's really unfair. And the court said, and it could be talking about this case, said the defendant was present at sentencing where the special parole term was imposed. He's being detained only because he committed a new crime. Under these cases, there's nothing unfair about that. So I think, granted it's put in a different legal pigeonhole, but the facts couldn't be more similar. And in terms of the equities, the unfairness, I think the fact remains that although the initial allegations of probation violations did not all involve new crimes, only one of them did, the division administrator revoked Mr. Greer's probation only because he committed a new crime.
Counsel, if they had discovered their mistake, the DOC, after the 3 years, that is after September 28, 2010, how would that affect your analysis and argument?
The department would have been powerless. He would have finished his three-year, if I've got my chronology, he would have been finished with his term of probation, regardless of whether the department realized he had been on probation that time term or not. There would be nothing. In fact, it was the Rodriguez case, where the defendant finished his 3 years, whatever term of probation, and the circuit court tried to make him then serve a stayed conditional jail sentence, which he had never served because of a stayed pending appeal. And the Court of Appeals said, the term of probation or supervision is up. That's the end. Everybody has lost jurisdiction.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision here that's wrong?
I don't believe so.
Ken, with regard to equitable estoppel, you've advanced the argument that it has no place as a consideration in certiorari review. What would preclude a defendant from bringing an injunction action against the DOC, seeking that they be enjoined under the particular facts of this case from revoking?
Injunction,
of course, is inherently an equitable proceeding.
I think it's the principle that the certiorari review is the only method for challenging a probation or supervision revocation decision. There is that's the exclusive method of challenge.
Could I ask, I thought you answered the Chief Justice by saying the Department of Corrections had a sentencing transcript.
Well, that's not in the record. The as I understand, the procedure is a sentencing transcript is sent to the institution. That doesn't mean the Central Records Office would have it. This is just my assumption is that whoever is entering the data into the department's record-keeping system is working off a judgment of conviction.
Okay.
Now,
let me ask this. The third count that really is an issue here, what was that about?
That was a felon in possession. A felon in possession charge.
Okay.
The first count was, there were two counts, counts one and three. Count one was a THC possession, and the state imposed and stayed was.
So if it was a felon in possession of a firearm, that implies that he had a previous felony conviction. Is that right?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Now, would he have had a right to appeal the Court of Appeals his sentence?
The imposed and stayed sentence?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be normal that his attorney would discuss an appeal right with him?
One would hope that his attorney would. And we have nothing in the record about what his attorney may or may not have said to him after sentencing, about the sentence he received or his appeal rights. We do know that he says he didn't see the judgment of conviction, and we know, but the ALJ made no findings of fact. The department's representative at the revocation hearing said in Racine County the practice is to send the judgment of conviction to the attorney rather than to the defendant. We don't have anything in the record. We certainly don't have any factual findings that the defendant was unaware that a consecutive probation.
Okay. Now, we have a felon who's convicted of a felon in possession of a firearm. And all he gets for that is consecutive probation. But there is a stayed sentence.
There was a stayed sentence. That's right. He's.
I mean, aren't that's not too tough a sentence, is it?
You know, without knowing, you know, seeing the underlying file and the pre-sentence investigation report, without knowing whether there was an agreed-upon recommendation, I can't, you know, comment on that. But, yes, certainly having probation imposed for a felon in possession count.
But the point I'm trying to get at is this. There's a stayed sentence, a six-year stayed sentence. So he gets probation, but if he screws up on probation, he can get some real prison time out of that.
Correct.
Okay. Now, the fact that he had the right to appeal, an attorney normally discusses a right to appeal, and the fact that if he screwed up during probation, he could go to prison on that state sentence. Isn't that something that his trial attorney would have discussed with him?
It's certainly something his trial attorney should have discussed with him, yes.
Okay, so let's say the trial attorney didn't discuss that with him at all. Nothing. Okay, that's truly ineffective assistance. There's no claim of ineffective assistance here, is there?
No, there's no claim here. Putting it aside, even whether it's framed in terms of ineffective assistance, there's no. When Mr. Greer talked about no one talked to me about the consecutive probation term, I understood him to be talking about no one from DOC while he's at prison talked about it. And, of course, that's understandable because it wouldn't have been in the DOC's record. I don't think we can read the record to say I never talked to my attorney about what my sentence is and what my possible.
What have we heard from the trial attorney about this case?
Nothing.
Whose responsibility is that?
Well, I think if Mr. Greer wanted to make that a part of his argument, then it was his responsibility. I think the department had to prove at the administrative hearing on revocation, it had to prove that he was on probation, which he was, because it's our position the department never lost probation, and that he violated a condition of probation, and that was all but conceded because he committed a new crime. He had already entered a plea to the new crime.
The Court of Appeals, as I recall, indicated that the defendant knew or should have known that he was on probation. Is that a finding of fact?
No, I think that's based in. I don't think the Court of Appeals is making the finding of fact. My recollection is that the agents, the Division of Hearing and Appeals made that finding.
I mean, when I say finding of fact, certainly the Court of Appeals decision did not say finding of fact, but my recollection is that the analysis indicated that he knew or should have known,
right.
And that kind of statement is the kind of thing I often attribute to the words of a circuit court who's determining if something was known or if something was not known.
I'm looking at the appeal decision. It is in Mr. Greer's appendix at 134.
Mm-hmm.
This is the decision that's being reviewed. This is the fact finder. It's the administrative. It's the division administrator saying at the last few sentences, as a practical matter, Greer would have been in court at sentencing and therefore knew or should have known that he was required to serve a consecutive probation term. So this was
a finding of law, isn't it?
Excuse me?
Isn't this a finding of law?
So not that was knowing?
Yeah.
That should have known?
Yeah. And it just on the basis that one who is at sentencing knows or should have known what the sentence is. That is a conclusion of law. Unless you can rebut that.
So this is...
I don't know. I'm just suggesting. There's no evidence that he knew. There's no evidence here that he should have known because, as Justice Prosser questioned you, the lawyer had an obligation and did talk. What is known is that this is a presumption or an inference from the law, namely, you are at sentencing. Sentencing was pronounced. You are by law. No.
Well, I, at the risk of splitting hairs, they should have known maybe a matter of law. The new, an inference from a fact is still a fact.
A fact. But there's no fact here. What's the fact? That he was at sentencing.
That he was at sentencing. But I understood Justice Bradley's concern to be that the Court of Appeals was somehow making a factual finding.
And you're saying that it was referring to the finding of the administrator or to the words of the administrator. I think the administrator, the chief's question, concluded that.
Right. Whether it's characterized as a finding of fact or a conclusion of law, it is not something that the Court of Appeals found
point
concluded
well taken
on its own. If there are no further questions, I'll thank the Court.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Castle. Ms. Severino.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have a few brief points on rebuttal. Just wanted to address a couple of things that were argued. Clearly, the issue of jurisdiction would be asking this Court to create a bright-line rule. And Petitioner agrees that that rule doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room. And therefore, the substantive due process, procedural due process, estoppel applications would permit this Court to instruct the courts in the state to apply a case-by-case analysis either under the procedural or substantive due process or under the estoppel arguments. That presents the narrowest possible application and would permit them to look at cases like Mr. Greer, where an individual is discharged, whether it be wrongfully or not, and then in Mr. Greer's case, it was 2 years, 11 months, and 5 days later, get taken into custody without the notice and, you know, taken from the life that he had reestablished for himself. The example that's given by the state of a, you know, somebody who's a murderer who's in prison and the wrong name is on the discharge certificate, certainly that's the extreme example that could occur. But if we apply a case-by-case analysis under due process or under estoppel, then, or applying the estoppel standard, then we could avoid those type of cases from coming back in front of this court. One thing that the court questioned the state about and that I thought was a point that Mr. Greer made in our brief is that this was not just a simple clerical error. This was a cascade of errors by the Department of Corrections. It wasn't just, oops, we forgot to enter it into our computer system once. When you think about the sheer number of people who probably had their hands on that file during the three-year time period that he was either in prison or on extended supervision between the records department, social workers, his agent, the regional office who have to sign off on discharges, all of these people, the DOC conceded that the judgment of conviction was in the file and that it was correct the entire time, but no one caught this. And they failed in their duty to supervise them and failed in their duty to enact the court's order in this case. Mr. Greer indicated he would have complied with the order and would have followed the rules of probation and would have continued to report if he had simply been told to. And he would not have questioned that. And the fact of the matter is that he was never given that opportunity. With regards to the state's reliance on the Seventh Circuit's Matamoros case, in my reply brief, I addressed the great dissimilarities between the cases, and I think I just wanted to touch base real briefly on those. In Matamoros, the defendant was a parolee, not a probationer. So he was serving another portion of a sentence as opposed to Mr. Greer, who was under probation, which is an order of the court. Mr. Matamoros, as was indicated in the case, had numerous violations while he was on parole and had already gone through revocation numerous times, whereas Mr. Greer did not commit a single violation while he was on his 22 months of extended supervision. Furthermore, in Matamoros, notice was given to the defendant about the special parole period via telephone by his agent hours before he went out and committed an armed robbery. In this case, Mr. Greer was not given any notice that he was under probation rules and the possibility of revocation or the possibility of the six-year sentence coming down when he committed the new intimidation of a witness act. So the notice issue is huge difference between the Matamoros case and the case that we have before us, as is the character of the defendant and the nature of the crime that was committed. Again, we would ask this court to follow through with the department, with the due process analysis and application of equitable estoppel here. As we indicated during questioning, Mr. Greer is not asking that the Department of Corrections be prohibited from enforcing the probation. If jurisdiction is found to have been retained, the remedies available would be either to restart the probation or to permit him to discharge with the 27 days remaining to be served if he is given credit for time at large. The fact of the matter is he was told not to report, and he didn't. He said he would report had he been told, and he should not be punished for the Department of Corrections' failure to comply and failure to monitor him. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you, Ms. Severino, and you, Mr. Castle, for your arguments today on probation and the effect of violation thereof when the defendant alleges that he was discharged. That concludes our argument in 11AP 2188, State of Wisconsin ex rel Donna Squia versus Wiedenhoft. Thank you. The court will be in recess for a few minutes so that the students may leave and others may arrive. We are in recess.
Chief Justice, if you could remind them that I will come and speak
with
them.
Oh, I'm sorry.
After the last
if those of you who are staying till noon, Justice Rogensack will be out to discuss the procedures of the court at that time. We are in recess.